Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Could Earth's temperature really go up 6 degrees centigrade in just one decade? Our guest is Paul Beckwith, an undergraduate climate scientist from the University of Ottawa. He says this climate nightmare could happen. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, good. I'd first like to ask you, you have a background in engineering and physics. Why did you choose to study our climate?
Well, I've always been sort of interested informally in following climate and meteorology over the years. You know, I did the engineering degree many years ago in engineering physics. Then I stayed in school and did a master's degree in laser physics and then worked many years in that field. But like I say, you know, I've been sort of keeping an eye on what's going on with the climate. You know, in the last number of years, I've been very concerned about the rapidity of the changes. So I thought I might as well formalize my learning in the area and go back to graduate school and get the PhD in the area.
Well, we're all really concerned about that. But before we get to talking about that, I also read a blog post by you in which you described some of the basic physics of the way our planet works as far as temperature goes. And I think a lot of our listeners may not realize as the poles are warming, that changes the dynamics of things. I mean, we count on having cold poles and a hot center, but what happens when that changes?
Well, very interesting question. I mean, a lot of people have the misconception that the Arctic can be treated separately sort of from the rest of the climate. And, you know, as the Arctic's warming, it's the polar bears and the people living up in that region that, you know, are most at risk for changes. But what actually happens is the temperature gradient between the equator, which is generally fairly warm and unvarying in temperature, I mean, places on the equator have a temperature change of maybe 3 degrees mean annual temperature throughout the year, because they always get the 12 hours of sunlight year-round. They don't have this seasonal change in hours of daylight. So in the Arctic in particular, in the summer, the Arctic's warmer and the temperature gradient between the equator and the pole is smaller. So the jet streams, there's not as much cold air, so the jet streams are kind of confined closer up into the Arctic. They basically separate the cold air from the warm air. In the winter, you know, as the sun moves south and the poles, you know, naturally cool from the seasonal effect, that increases the temperature gradient. And basically, the winds that flow around the Earth in the jet streams increase significantly when there's a larger temperature gradient. Because when there's a temperature gradient, that creates a pressure gradient. And it's the pressure gradient that drives the winds. And the winds move from west to east because of the rotation of the Earth, giving rise to the Coriolis force.
I get the idea that if we change the differentiation between the poles and the warmer center, then we are going to change the weather for the whole planet. Is that what we're getting to?
Yes. I mean, mostly for the northern hemisphere, because the southern hemisphere is a bit different. But as the planet warms, the poles are warming at a much faster rate because there's a lot of reflective material up in the Arctic. Like the sea ice cover is typically, with a bit of snow on top, it's very white. It reflects about 90% of the incoming light from the sun. Same with the snow cover in the winter on the ground reflects a lot of the sunlight. So with the warming from the greenhouse gases, that's melting the sea ice, it's also melting the snow. So the snow cover is actually decreasing at an amazingly fast rate. It's about 17 or 18% per decade reduction in area for about the last 3 decades. And the sea ice is also exhibiting, you know, a rapid decline. So when you get rid of sea ice, you have dark ocean. When you get rid of snow cover, you have dark permafrost and dark ground. So the amount of absorption of energy from the sun is much, much greater. So the high Arctic is warming, you know, 5-6 times the rate that the average temperature is rising on the whole planet. Because of that albedo effect, the albedo is basically collapsing in the Arctic. It's basically dropping significantly, causing the Arctic to warm that much greater. And then that ties into the jet streams, as I mentioned, so it makes them wavier. It slows them down, so they then become sort of stuck to certain persistent positions depending on the ocean-land contrast, and they get locked into position. So, for example, a couple of years ago, they were locked. So the trough of the wave, this enormous wave, was over Pakistan, and the crest, the peak of the wave, was over Russia, and it didn't move for 35 days. So the net result is, in the trough, there's low pressure, there's lots of rain, so Pakistan was basically flooded out, and Moscow was under the high pressure of the ridge. It had a heat wave. It was over 30 degrees for 35 days. I think it killed about 50,000 extra Russians over the normal mortality rate. And they lost 40% of their grain crop, their wheat crop, so they didn't export that year. They kept the grain they did produce up there. And also, it really dried out the areas over Moscow with the high pressure area, no rain, very arid, soils dried out, and there were forest fires galore. So we've been seeing this stuck pattern over the U.S. this last year. We've seen this high pressure ridge. Stay over, the farming belt here is in the U.S. Southwest. So basically, you know, we've had this persistent drought going. So as the sea ice declines, you know, much like in the next few years, as it declines more and more, it's very possible that these conditions will be persistent conditions. They'll be the new sort of conditions. And that's the worrying thing, because the food supply, probably the Earth system that is most liable to be affected by the rapid, abrupt changes that we're seeing in the climate. I mean, that's the worrying thing for humans.
And what you've just described is what Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers has also described that we've been seeing. And I questioned her. I said, well, what do you think about this as a theory? She said, well, this isn't a theory. This is a series of observations, and that's what we published.
I just wanted to mention with Dr. Francis that she's been working with the jets sort of for years. She published her paper in March. I mean, I've been talking about the jets and the interactions with climate probably for, you know, about the last year and a half. It's just that I haven't talked to her, but I've had emails with her and stuff, but also with Trenberth, Kevin Trenberth. And I talked to him just about a week ago about this, because he talked about extreme weather, but he never mentioned sea ice and being interacting with the jets. I asked him that question, and he said, well, you know, Francis's work is showing that both the sea ice is going and the jets are changing, he said, but it didn't indicate causality. I said to him, the causality is basic physics, and this is becoming very multidisciplinary. So my engineering view on systems and my understanding of physics is indicating to me that there is a direct causality, but it's not being recognized by some of the biggest names in climatology. So I'm going to work on putting together some papers for the literature to show those direct linkages.
Let's get to this idea of a sudden shift or a fairly rapid shift. Now, a couple of years ago, I interviewed a top American scientist, Dr. Michael McCracken, about a compilation of papers published in a book called Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change that was published by EarthScan. The authors took the subject quite seriously, as you do, but I came away with the impression that the best known rapid changes they could find were cooling events rather than warming. Do we have records of rapid warming in the past?
So in terms of the rapid event, it's very important to try to get a handle on how quickly things are going to change, because if you look at sea ice in the Arctic, if you look at the area decline of sea ice, and computer models that try to project, you know, what's going to happen in the future, most of the models are showing that it will maybe disappear by about 2040 to 2070, that sort of time range. I mean, that's the widespread view of, like, the British meteorological people, you know, mainstream modelers. But if you look at the volume of the sea ice, it's declining much more quickly. And in fact, we lost about 20% of what was left in 2007, the previous minimum, in the space of about a week, you know, in early August as the cyclone went through. And it ended up much, much lower, 18, 20% lower at the end of the melt season. You know, if you just do a simple extrapolation fit to the data of volume, it looks like there's about a 50% probability that the ice is gone in September, the end of the melt season, in about 2015, with maybe a 5, 10% chance of it happening even next year. So it's going very quickly. So where is this going to take us? How quickly can the climate system of the Earth switch? As you say, there's something called the Dansgaard-Oscher oscillations, and these are typically when the Earth is much, much cooler. There has been spikes in the temperature of the 6 to 8 degrees, and it happens over, you know, in a decade or two. I mean, you can't really resolve down to the fine detail and see whether it's actually shorter than that, but that's sort of the maximum limit. you know, when the temperature has jumped up 6 to 8 degrees and then stayed there for a while and then it's declined back down 6 to 8 degrees. But most of the data is, as you say, it's when the Earth is much colder and, you know, it's about 5 degrees or so colder than it is today. It's in sort of in the cold period of the ice age cycle. Wally Brokaw has a very good book. It's called The Great Ocean Conveyor, Discovering the Trigger for Abrupt Climate Change. So he was one of the big name climatologists who examined this idea that when we were coming out of the last ice age, there were these large pools of fresh water trapped over the land and by these ice dams. And when these dams gave way, you'd get an outpouring of fresh water into the Arctic. And that basically disrupted the thermohaline circulation and shut down the Gulf Stream. So that plunged the region up there into a cooling period, which lasted for basically a couple of thousand years until the ocean currents restarted and the period warmed up again. So this was a case where the north would get very, very cold and then it would get very, very warm. But there are periods in Earth's history where there's been large amounts of methane. I mean, methane is really the key. We have to get a better handle on methane. Like, we have to get better measurement because it's very sort of amazing how quickly it's starting to rise in the Arctic. I mean, the Russians went off the East Siberian Arctic Shelf and they measured plumes of methane tens of meters in diameters a few years ago. About a year ago, they went back and these plumes were up to 1.5 kilometers in diameter. So they'd grown from tens of meters to kilometers in diameter. There were a significant number, and it was thought that methane over that ice shelf would stay trapped in the marine sediments, but the water temperature is about 50 meters deep over those shells, and the water temperature has risen significantly, like 3, 4, 5 degrees, you know, in the last several years, and it's perforating through the seafloor, releasing that methane. There's also been methane releases recorded off Svalbard, and that's much deeper water. And in fact, I saw a paper just, you know, in the last couple, well, a couple papers in the last couple months. One of them was talking about the methane emissions from the coastlines because, you know, methane's also coming up from the terrestrial tundra and permafrost as it's warming, but it's also coming up in larger amounts from coastlines because as the ocean is opened up, you get more cyclones, more, you know, like the one that happened in early August of this year. You know, very unusual, very strong cyclone covered most of the Arctic, sucked up warm air from Siberia, warm air with smoke from many forest fires. It was 20 degrees Celsius over Siberia, and it basically churned up the ice in the Arctic. Because it's a very low-pressure area, the cyclone, it raises up the sea level about a foot, basically over most of the Arctic Ocean, which then drew in warm water from the Pacific through the Bering Strait, plus Atlantic waters. That contributes to the melt. And it actually brought water up from about 500 meters deep, which is warmer water. So all of these things contributed to the melting. So the methane's definitely on the rise up there. Also, the Gulf Stream actually shifted a bit over to the eastern coast of the U.S., and it was warming the seafloor off the eastern U.S. So, I mean, it moved to where it wasn't going before, and people were actually measuring methane rising off the eastern seaboard of the U.S. as well. Now, people that measure it in the Arctic, it's measured by satellites. There's one called AIRS. You can Google it, A-I-R-S, and there's another one. I also got some data from Yurgumov, a Russian, and he presented a couple papers at AGU just last week, the big conference, you know, detailing the methane rises. And it's also measured in flasks, just, you know, measurements at ground level from sites up there. And both measurements at Svalbard and Barlow, Alaska, are showing very elevated levels, like levels of methane up to 2,100, 2,200 parts per billion I've seen. You know, normally, you know, about the global concentration's about 1750 right now. So this is a significant increase. And if you look at the global increase of methane, it kind of was kind of stable until about 2007. But there's been a, you know, relatively sharp and well-defined uptick since that time. So, you know, that's the concern because there's a misconception about methane. People say that the global warming potential of methane is about 21 or 25 times. That's correct, but that's averaged over 100 years. I mean, methane has a lifetime typically of about 12 years. So, you know, on a short time scale of a year or two, the global warming potential of methane is about 150 times higher than CO2. So one molecule of methane can cause that, 150 times more warming than one molecule of CO2. So because it's concentrated, the source is the Arctic, and it's concentrated and localized, it's a definite heating source there. The meteorology of the Arctic is very bizarre right now. In fact, before you called, I was just generating some movies of, what it's doing in the long-range forecasts. And there's ridging. I mean, there's not much cold air up there. The pattern is not regular like it used to be. There used to be a strong polar vortex that sort of confined it, mostly west to east winds. But the winds are very wavy. The Rossby waves are, extremely wavy, and they rotate around and they slice through. And when the trough slices through where you're living, like in Ottawa, for example, it's like minus 10 degrees now. When the ridge was slicing through Ottawa last week, it reached about 18 degrees Celsius in Ottawa just last week. I wore shorts last week, and I as I look on the pattern changing, this is going to be what's happening. You get the ridge and you get the trough, and you get really warm, really cold. Normally we expect that as you go north, it gets colder. As you go south, it gets warmer. But what's happening is, if you're under the jet stream, it's warmer. You're getting air from south. If you're above it, it's colder. You're getting air from the north. And because these things are so wavy and the amplitude of the waves can cross almost the whole continent, 1,500 kilometers or more, you get these bizarre changes, and they can be very rapid because as the wave moves past you, you could have it great one day and super warm one day, super cold the next day. So it's really bizarre, and I'm convinced that it's tied to sea ice. There's a lot of factors at play here. The problem is that scientists are too compartmentalized. You got the permafrost guy, you got the Arctic sea ice guy, you got the guy looking at the greenhouse gas concentrations, and they're not all talking to each other, so they don't know what the other guy's doing. That's why the systems approach of the whole system, what it's doing, what is happening, how it's evolving, that's what I'm really looking at, and it's very frightening.
Well, now, not everybody agrees with you. You know that.
Of course.
I interviewed three scientists about the threat of Arctic methane not too long ago for Radio EcoShock, and Dr. Peter Wadhams was one of my guests, and he very cogently explained his worries about increasing emissions of this dangerous gas. But Dr. David Archer from the University of Chicago said the emissions are still very small, much less, for example, than those generated in the tropics by things like rice paddies. How do you respond to those kind of cautions?
This is great. A day for me, because Peter Wadhams, I'm emailing and in constant contact with him. He's also a member of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. He's one of the UK's top sea ice guys. He's been in the submarines and measured thicknesses of ice and so on. He had a Scientific American article, and he's really pushing the idea, like myself, that we need to regionally cool the Arctic to keep the ice there and the methane in place. And then you have David Archer. He's very well known in climatology. He's written numerous books. I've read some of them. Did you ask him, for example, about the recent Russian work with, there's Yurgumov is one of the scientists.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. That's Natalie Shikova.
Yeah, she's the one. The Independent newspaper in the UK, they had reference to her work about a year ago, because that was when they measured that these plumes had increased in size to a kilometer more in diameter over the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And they measured the methane coming up, and they mapped it and where it was coming up and so on. But it was the rate of change. It was minimal 2 years previous, and then it became huge. If you look at the AERS data from the Arctic, you can look at it every year over the last decade, and the map has just exploded in red, and red is the color of higher methane. It's just exploded across the entire Arctic region just in the last year or two, and same with the other satellite data. So I would have to ask Archer, have you seen all of this latest data? What's even more absurd to me is that the IPCC, their next report, they've actually publicly stated that they're not going to be considering methane levels rising, in the Arctic too much for their report. And the climate, all the models, they treat methane as like a constant. But perforation of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, the seafloor, the methane coming up, this was never even considered. Everybody thought that the methane would stay down in those sediments, that there was an impermeable barrier. And no, it's coming up. You know, it's hard for everybody to keep up with this stuff, right? So these guys are great guys, but if they don't have data from the last year or two, then they're not seeing what's going on.
Right. I think the IPCC is definitely always 5 years behind the curve. And if the climate can change in 5 years, as we're talking about right now, that's a big problem.
Radio EcoShock.
Well, let's put this together, Paul Beckwith. Can you please describe a scenario where the Earth could warm 6 degrees centigrade within a decade?
Within a decade or two. Let's say that the volume data on sea ice is correct. The melt season is usually about mid-September, so say around mid-September, maybe beginning of September in 2015, the Arctic Ocean becomes totally clear of sea ice, okay, effectively, maybe a little bit around shorelines and stuff, but it's gone. So then basically the forcings from the Arctic, all that open water, you know, the additional heat and so on, it adds extra energy to the atmosphere. So it takes a lot longer for the ice to freeze up because all that heat is now stored in the ocean. In fact, parts of the Arctic Ocean are completely open now in the Barents Sea this year. If it's gone completely in 2015, the PO mass models, they show that within about a year, so about 2016, 2017, the ice is gone for 3 months of the year in the Arctic. So say, you know, it might be gone July, August, September. Now, if you extrapolate the graphs that show how the ice is declining in each month of the year, it does decline. There's less of it even in the winter months. Every single month of the year has less of it. So if you do a bit of extrapolation and track down, you can. These models seem to indicate that you can lose the ice year-round in the Arctic within about 10 years from where the model shows. And this model did not even account for cyclone activity, for upwelling of warmer water, for these massive cyclones that last for very long duration in the Arctic, raise the water level, suck in warm water. If there's no snow and ice in the Arctic year-round, like if there's no sea cover, no sea ice, then we're in a much warmer state. Like the methane comes up, everything, all the feedbacks kick in, and we've had a state in the Arctic. I mean, look in the paleo records. The Arctic was, the continents were basically where they were, but we still had the seasonality. But we had, you know, tropical forests in the Arctic. We had frogs and we had snakes and we had various creatures that would die if it went below 0 degrees. You know, so the mean annual temperatures year round were above freezing, and you know, we had quite a different state. Now you can imagine in that type of situation what the jet streams are going to do. I mean, the jet streams, as they become slower and wavier, you know, they start to break up. You get a much more sort of fractured type of system. I mean, there might be a very weak jet due to the humidity difference between the equator and the Arctic. That may give rise. That's still going to be there, you know, when there's no ice at all in the Arctic. But so that might give some organization to the system. And these changes can happen this fast. So it's I think people better, you know, need to start waking up to the reality of what's going on. You know, I've just generated all these movies of the Arctic, what it's doing right now with the, and, you know, the changes are remarkable. There's very little cold air up there. Very little cold air. I mean, the changes right now, you know, every time I see these changes, they support sort of some of the views that I have that this system can change extremely rapidly.
If that happened, would it be too late to do anything about it?
Okay, so this is the key question. So we have a couple choices. We can do nothing, right? We can slowly ramp up renewables, slowly try to get a sort of some control of these escalating emissions. You know, lose the sea ice, see this rapid shift to a much warmer world. You know, with a lot of instability, a lot of geopolitical risks, a lot of scrambling for resources, food shortages, huge spikes in prices. The UN is projecting global food shortages next year. I mean, you know, we start getting that sort of thing, then everybody will be alerted to climate change and what it can do. and be screaming for people to do stuff. So the group I was talking about, Arctic Methane Emergency Group, you can Google it. We've been a group about a year and a couple months. It started with a conference in Britain. We say that it is absolutely vital, if we want to preserve a stable climate system, that we geoengineer and regionally cool the Arctic. There's still risks, right? Some people say, well, I mean, you are tinkering with things, but the risks of doing nothing seem to be much, much greater to us. So what would we do? I mean, one of the ideas that would probably work the quickest and easiest would be to inject some sulfur up into the stratosphere in the Arctic regions. A couple aircraft could do that, and then that would basically simulate the effects of a volcano, right? A large volcano will inject ash and sulfur up into the stratosphere, and because you're above the weather, it doesn't rain up there. The sulfur stays up there for years, and you know, a big volcano can cool the planet half a degree or a degree for 2-3 years. So if you inject the aerosols up there and cool that region, then you can start restoring the sea ice, which will then start bringing stability back to the jet streams and the climate system. This is what our group has been pushing for. We have been making some headway with mainstream media, with more articles. We've got some very good scientists in our group, but there's a movie maker, there's a medical doctor who's retired, there's all these different people. In fact, I just saw a couple articles with David Keith. I mean, he's one of the big geoengineering people from, University of Calgary. And he's written a couple articles lending support to the idea that, yes, we could quickly put together technology to regionally cool the Arctic. But the political will and the bureaucracy and the thing, if we delay too long, if we let the Arctic, all the sea ice and the snow cover decline in the Arctic so that these positive feedbacks kick in, then we'll probably have lost that window to effectively, you know, restore a stable climate. There's a huge urgency to this because of the positive feedback. So this is what the AMEG group, which I've been a member of for a year, is trying to purport. And like, basically, we can regionally cool the Arctic. You know, we can physically do it.
Is there a website or a blog for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group?
Yes, I think it's just ameg.me or something, or if you just Google Arctic Methane Emergency Group, we have lots of documents, lots of stuff. Website's getting quite good.
And as we wrap up, Paul Beckwith, is there anything you'd like to add?
The key is the public is starting to wake up to the recognizing that something's not right. Like just winter's not like it used to be. Summer's not like it used to be. You know, extremes of weather, there's more hurricanes, there's more tornadoes, there's derechos crossing the country, straight line winds, there's haboobs, which is dust storms, there's, you know, massive droughts. If the drought continues, the Mississippi could drop enough that the barges can't go, and that's a huge economic penalty just from that. You know, the UN's talking about food. I mean, listen to what the scientists are saying. Start taking political action. Write letters, demand that things be done. Right? I mean, I don't think anything's going to happen personally until people start paying double for food or something in a year. You know, we just need one, if this drought continues, imagine this drought continuing for 10 years, this big, huge drought in the U.S., 10 years, 15 years. You know, how is this society going to adapt to this? We got to start thinking about all these things, and very quickly.
Our guest has been Paul H. Beckwith, who is moving from his background in engineering and physics to study climate change as a priority at the University of Ottawa. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be sure and visit our website at ecoshock.org to download all our past programs. Please make a donation if you can to keep the site full of free downloads for everyone. And find the links for this program in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for donating your attentive mind to our broadcast this week.